Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This time, I'm introducing you to Mari Reisberg. And on her profile, she says, "I'm funny and I love to laugh." And as you'll hear throughout this entire conversation, that's practically all we do. And one of my favorites, one of the easiest conversations I've had in a very long time. And such a pleasure to have her on the show. Mari's been in the performing arts and healing arts fields for the past 25 years, and we talk a little bit as to how she got there. But she also, unbelievably, became a trapeze artist at the ripe old age of three. Three! I just kind of, my jaw dropped when I heard that, and I thought, what was I doing when I was 3 years old? I think I was just sucking on my thumb. But by that age, Mari was leaps and bounds ahead all of us. And I think that automatically makes her pretty incredible. We talk a lot about psychic abilities. We talk about legacies, about ancestry, where these gifts come from. We talk about telling stories and listening to people's stories, because both she and I love to hear other people's stories. From soup to nuts, this was just a really fun interview. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Mari Reisberg.
This was back in the days of the flip phone, and his name like popped up on the little screen. And in my dream, I picked up the phone and I said, "Hi, oh my gosh, how are you?" And he said, "I just called to say goodbye."
How do you self-describe? If you had to get up on a stage and introduce yourself, let's say 50,000 people. How would you do that? I know 50,000 people.
I love that question, because of the number really changes how you show up and how you would introduce yourself. I guess part of me feels like I hope it doesn't influence it, but it totally does. So for 50,000 people, I would say that I am a creative at heart, and I have a lot of titles and letters to show up after that. But my heart of hearts, I am a creative soul. I also have a history of being an actor, singer, dancer. I have a degree in acting. I also have a degree in somatic psychology, and I'm a therapist in Colorado. I love to sing. I love sharing creativity with people who think they're creative, who don't think they're creative. Having someone in front of me experience their own creativity for the first time is the most exciting thing I can witness and be a part of and share with others.
So I'm curious, did you want to be an actor ever since you were a kid?
I did. I was a very rowdy three-year-old. My mother was pregnant with my younger brother, and I got sent to trapeze school, actually. So I started trapeze at three, and I did it until I was 20. So 17 years of being a trapeze artist. And that was where the performing bug bit me. And I've loved being on stage and have been on stage ever since. I am a true extrovert. I love performing. And that has always been a huge part of my life.
Well, okay. So I have to say that whenever I see in the movies or in shows, the trapeze artists get up there and they're, you know, hanging by their knees and they're flying around and doing these flips in the air and what have you, the most fun part seems like when you get to fall in the bouncy net. Is that right?
I guess I should clarify. the version of trapeze I did was aerial dance. So the trapeze could be 2 feet off the floor or 30 feet off the floor. No net. So there wasn't a net that we were falling into, which looks amazing. I've never actually done that before, but it was just a trapeze that you could touch the ground and swing on, or it was much higher in the air and you were swinging, but not flipping or falling.
Okay. And are you, is it with like a hoop or is it with?
That's lira. And okay. So yes, we were doing that, and silks and Spanish web, which is like the rope that at the top has a hand loop where people will grab a hold of and someone on the bottom spins them around and around. And it was also very physical theater as well.
Yeah. Did you ever want to puke? I would have puked.
I do now when I go back and like try it. However, when I was much younger, it was no, the vestibular system in my ear was much better than it is currently.
So you're not scared of heights?
No.
I've always found trapeze artists, aerial artists to be utterly fascinating. Partially one of the most beautiful types of aerial art that I've seen is with silks, where yes. you wind yourself up and you can mm-hmm. drop 10 feet by letting a silk go. And everybody in the audience is like, oh my God. Yeah. It looks, I mean, first of all, everyone I've seen who does it is in insane shape. You have to be in insane shape.
Yes and no. I feel like when you start it so young, your body just kind of learns how to do it in a way that if you learned it older, you're using different muscles, you're using different coordination pieces. Because I was learning how to do it when I was 6, 7, 8, 15. And your body is constantly changing so much at that time. Also, you're constantly learning your body in space in a different and unique way as well. So I think it would have been very different if I had started doing it when I was 20 than if I'd started doing it when I did.
Oh yeah, for sure. Please tell me that you considered running away to join the circus.
Well, I felt like I kind of grew up in the circus because so many of the people who were also a part of this trapeze school had been in Ringling Brothers or Cirque du Soleil and had just found their way to this little trapeze school and physical theater community in Portland, Oregon, that it was, I kind of felt like I didn't have to leave home. My parents sent me to the circus school, but I did. There was a period in my life where I thought I would really love to join Cirque du Soleil, but not as a aerialist, but as a singer, because that is where another deep passion of mine lays in singing.
Okay. I have to tell you that I think you and I, cause I was on your podcast, I told you I lived in Portland for 23 years, right? Yeah.
Yes.
You know that. So, you know, with everything, so you have to know, I'm sure your voice is 10 million times better than mine. I was in swing choir. I'm not the most coordinated person on the planet. But you know, with everything that's been going on with the protests and stuff in Portland, I just have this urge now in Santa Fe, when I think of Portland, to start belting out from Les Mis, one of the songs from Les Mis, just as I'm walking yes. around the house.
Yes.
We need more singing in general, you know?
I agree. I wholeheartedly agree. And Les Mis is a great musical to be singing right now.
True.
Yeah.
Are you soprano or an alto?
Both, all of the wow. above. Yeah. When I was younger, I was the one in the rafters. And now I've come down a little more of a mezzo.
Lots of things shift as you age. And I guess
this is very true. Very,
yes.
very true.
So I'd love to know how you eventually, you know, first of all, I dreamt about leaving and going to the circus. I'm not going to lie about that. I think every kid dreams about running away at some point or another when they're a child. But how did you get into this work that you're doing now, the somatic work?
Yeah. So because movement has always been such a big part of my life, and I feel like I learned so much about myself as a person, as a woman, as a human through movement, whether it was folk dancing, PE, or, you know, climbing walls or ropes or things at the theater, or and being on stage and taking movement classes and taking all of these things. And also growing up in the family that I did, movement was such a huge part. We were always dancing. Later on, my mother became a labyrinth facilitator. And so I grew up with a 30-foot sacred geometric walking path in my front yard. So I spent a lot of time walking that as a kid and a teenager. And that all of that, you know, I left Portland and got as far away and went to college in Connecticut for acting. And then I moved to New York City. And while I lived in New York City, all these pieces started to come together in a different flavor, in a different way, how I was really missing the movement and how acting didn't quite hold the same juice for me as it once had. And it's not to say that I don't love it, but I could see myself doing other things and I wanted to do other things. And that's where the world of somatic psychology I got introduced to, that through the creative arts therapies. Mm-hmm. Initially it was, well, what about drama therapy? I don't know if you have experienced this, but anywhere I go, someone will find me and tell me their life story, whether I've asked them a question or not. Yes. I could be on a plane, in a cab, getting my nails done at a bar. It doesn't matter. Someone's going to see me and think, oh, you look like a nice person. I'm going to tell you my life story unprompted. So I started thinking, oh, yeah, I should get paid for this. What? I wonder how I could do that. I wonder how to put all of that together. And so I had a phone conversation with my dad about, well, I don't want to do just straight talk therapy. And he said, well, have you looked into creative arts therapies? There's actually a lot of them. And I figured, you know, drama therapy, I just done 4 years of drama school. That wasn't really what I wanted to keep doing. And there's music therapy and art therapy. And then I was introduced to dance and movement therapy. And I thought, ooh, that is 1,000,000% speaks to my soul, how movement and your body can change your whole experience. You can heal. Our body holds so much more information than our brain even has the awareness of, that it can be a tool for change. And that was kind of the first connecting the dots for me in my life. And so that took me to Boulder, Colorado, where I went to Naropa, a very tiny Buddhist inspired university, where all of my classes were taught sitting on cushions and meditating. And so 3 years of meditation class and on top of psychology, and all done through experiential learning, was quite the eye-opening experience, but offered a reconnecting to myself in a very different way. I grew up in a family of very, very spiritual individuals, and then got as far away from that as possible, kind of left all of that and moved to the East Coast. And once I moved to New York, started feeling like something was missing, this reconnection to my soul. And so that's kind of where I reinvigorated that, or rediscovered that through my own version of connecting with, you know, angel therapy and more of the world, the unseen world, if you will. I had grown up with that as a child. I was the kid in the garden talking to plants and having moments with fairies and all of that. And I remember my mom at one point telling me, you know, in kindergarten, your feet just don't, they haven't arrived on the ground yet. you live in such of this very magical world. And that is truly what it felt like. I lived in this very magical, mystical world, and my feet hadn't quite firmly landed on the ground.
I love that. I love that. It's especially powerful when you consider that you joined like this local circus and, you know, spent 17 years, I think you said it was, in the air, which I find utterly fascinating. This segues so nicely into my second question, which was, did you grow up in a religious household? And it sounds like it was spiritual, but I'd love to know more about that. What did it look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, my dad grew up and was raised Jewish. My mom grew up in a Christian household, but has always been a very spiritual human in terms of beliefs. She grew up overseas. It was boarding school for lots of things. And so her kind of understanding of spirituality was what we did, what we kind of, I will say my parents were very open to any question my brother and I had about religion or about, you know, if we were curious about something, we would be able to experience it or have conversations about it. And then my brother and I got to choose what we wanted to believe in. So it was this very, like, I hate to use this term, smorgasbord, but that's what it kind of felt like of here are all of the things you could choose from. Now you get to choose what your soul is called to and what you want to believe in and how that then shows up in your own life. So, I mean, my mom was a psychic medium for years, and she and I had this very, what may sound bizarre to other people, but was very normal for me growing up, that I would ask her a question in my head and she would answer it out loud and vice versa. And so this is very deep connection that I had with my mom. And so that was like, we grew up doing crossing over ceremonies for spirits that were stuck energetically in the house that we lived in. So I remember being in fourth grade and like standing at the top of the stairs with my dad and my brother and my mom and doing a ceremony to support this spirit to cross over. And that was normal. And so when I got to, you know, high school, college, and I'm telling people these stories, they're like, no, that's not normal. That is not what we experienced growing up at all. So
I have to tell you that that is amazing. And what a singular childhood. But also, I so appreciate that your father and your brother were like, we're here for this too. We totally support, you know, all of this. It's very interesting. Have you been listening to the telepathy tapes?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I think you would love that podcast. It's kind of exploded. But in that show, they talk about primarily, the host starts with the nonverbal autistic community and what their teachers, social workers, parents, caregivers have been telling everybody that's been going on for decades, and how the scientific community is like, no, it's all fake. No, it's all fake. No, it's all fake. And just kind of this, you know, I don't know. It's actually quite fascinating. In your vocation now, I think you'd find it fascinating, but they very, you know, cleanly and clearly talk about that the kids are very telepathic and can answer questions, even though they're nonverbal, they have these spellers. And so when you tell me stories like this, I say, of course, you know, of course, like it doesn't sound strange to me. It's just that in your lineage, your ancestry, your family, what have you, however you want to define that, that talent is not latent. It's been developed. And that everybody has it to varying degrees. So I just think that's absolutely. So, I mean, no wonder you didn't want to come down to Earth. I wouldn't have wanted to come down to Earth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's for the birds. I mean, I'd rather be floating around in some ethereal space anyway. And the idea, you know, I've certainly had guests come on and talk about seeing angels, particularly one when he was a young boy of like 8 or 9, an angel came to him, or what he thought was an angel, and told him something. Yeah. But I think it all goes to say, or what I'm trying to suggest is that, and I think you will probably agree with me, is that there are a lot more living beings in this creation than we actually can see with our eyes or want to acknowledge, right? A lot of people don't even want these things to exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or they do on some level because of some, I can't think of the word, but it's like everyone who goes to the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, where The Shining was filmed or written, and they want to have a extraterrestrial or ghost experience, and going and looking for it, I'm like, it's probably never going to happen. But if you don't look for it, that's when it will. So people seeking some of those more mainstream or acceptable versions of contacting or being connected to something bigger than us or outside of us, in terms of angels, fairies, gnomes, the ethereal world. So it's an interesting, it's just an interesting path to walk and how to talk about it. Because I mean, so much of energy is here forever. I'm using air quotes of like, you know, when the science that they scientists talk about, when someone dies, their energetic mark remains, whether you call it spirit, whether you call it soul, whether, you know, there is this piece that is still here because of the energy of that living being. Plants have this, trees have this, animals have this, people have this. So to think that we are the only living beings, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. And, you know, I mean, I think what's especially fascinating is that, I don't know if you're into science, but several years ago, they proved the existence of the Higgs field and the Higgs boson, which, you know, unilaterally proved that there are other dimensions,
right,
than the ones that we, you know, have already classified. And, you know, there are so many tales from all over the world about Yetis and Sasquatch. There are so many tales all over the world about aliens or whatever, strange beings, whatever you want to say. And I've thought for years, you know, probably along with millions of other people, but I'm like, who's to say they aren't just beings or energetic imprints that come from another dimension? They just have learned the art of crossing or traveling through, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes down to it, we know some things, but not very much about our reality,
right,
to be honest. And, you know, this childhood that you had, and I love that your mom built a labyrinth, because that is like no joke. That's a lot of work. Yeah. But the fact that you grew up in this kind of illuminated and gorgeous space where everything was possible, and you didn't have any adults saying, no, that's your imagination. No, that's not real, sweetie, and patting you on the head and then walking away. You were able to, and are able to, exist in the world more deeply. Like, I'd say you're more deeply invested into the world because you know how far the world goes, to the extent that you do. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I guess I've never really thought about it. The deepness of understanding of a world that is so layered, that has so many dimensions and facets and experiences that are explainable and unexplainable, that I've had in my own life or heard from other people or friends or witnessed others' experiences of that. So that, yeah, it is a deepness. And, you know, it's not to say that my parents didn't at some times in my life, like, tell me those things. And, you know, creativity, while I didn't name it as such growing up, was such a huge part of my childhood. I remember my parents trying to get my brother and I to go on a very long hike to overlook the Pacific Ocean to watch whales. The migration of whales. Yeah. And my brother and I, you know, maybe I was 9, he was 5 or 6, and we're just dragging our feet. And so my parents walked ahead on the trail and left cubes of cheese for us on the trail to keep us hiking. And they like knew how many they'd left. And so by the time we got to them with our, you know, cubes of cheese, they said, oh, how many did you find? Oh, we found this many. Oh, you missed some. And my very first response was, oh, those were for the gnomes. Like, those needed to be left for these other beings. We didn't need all of them. But it was a very normal conversation and normal experience in my childhood.
Yeah. Have you ever read any of Maladoma Somme?
No.
Oh my God. Okay. he's written several books that I've read that are just, he passed away a couple years ago. You must read him. The book that I would start with is Of Water and the Spirit. And he was from Africa. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, you know, one of the most fascinating in one of his books, he talks about getting stolen when he was a child by priests and then being forced to grow up in a Catholic, you know, and become a priest. Yeah. And then when he was 18, he left, escaped essentially, and had to walk the 500 miles back to his village, where he, you know, his father and his grandfather and his lineage was the medicine people or the shamans of his tribe. And they wouldn't accept him because he hadn't gone through initiation. And so you need to read this book, because he talks about, he says, look, kids died during this initiation. Like, it was, very serious. And the fact that he was so much older did him no good. And he said, I am going to try to tell you every part, but some of it is beyond words. You know, I can try. But the best part was, he said, when he was a kid, you know, he saw little people and, you know, they just came up from the ground, and he followed one for a while when his mom was getting water or something. And then the man like turned around, he's in a little suit and coat, and like said hello and then disappeared. And he was like, I think his mom said, what were you doing? And he's like, oh, I just followed this little man. And she's like, don't ever do that. It's dangerous. They're not your friends. But it allowed him to know at a very young age that there are things out there that, you know, our Western society or whatever you want to call it, culture says, don't exist. And I think the fact that, well, first of all, love your little child heart saying they're for the gnomes. But immediately I thought of that book. So powerful. And you can find these stories all over the world.
Yeah.
Of little people. So where are they coming from? That's my question.
Right. Or however we are cloaking a miracle or a miraculous event, they have been happening for centuries, hundreds of thousands of years in every corner of the world. And that's not something I find that it would be very hard to make all of all of these people made it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. One of the things I wanted to tell you was, it's so funny because in my family, also my brother, sister, and I, people just come up and start telling us their stories. And after a while, I came to realize that it's genetic in my family. But do you know what a charism is? The Catholic Church calls people's gifts or affinities, charisms, and they're the gifts given to you by God or the gods. Okay. And so you're expected, you know, you get several of them, but you're expected to live into your charisms because you're bequeathed them so that you can be of service to humanity. And so I find it fascinating that when I think one of your charisms is this energetic kind of openness that you carry, and people see you. And I suspect they don't think, oh, she looks nice. I think they suspect, you know, they feel your open heart, how welcoming you are, you're not going to turn them away, your joy perhaps. And they think I can make a real connection here. And I do think that just based on, you know, what happened with you as a kid and your telepathic conversations with your mother, your ability to be open, it kind of, it's like a superpower, but it can also be not so great sometimes. Yes. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there was a time and a point in my life where I really had to learn how to turn it down, because it got really, there were times where it was really loud and it was really challenging to navigate successfully or do the things I wanted to do. And my friends in college, we lived in a 300-year-old house that for sure there are ghosts. There are unexplainable things, butter dishes flying out of the refrigerator, candlesticks flying across the room. You know, I seeing Victorian clothed people in the basement, but this, and my friends will tell you that I get really bossy with them, with these spirits, to say, no, this is not your space. Your space is no longer here. And they give me a lot of crap about it, being really bossy with these spirits or other beings. And they used to, you know, like to play tricks and hide remotes and flip channels and tell me that's what it was. But it was just, I think that I did have to learn how to control it and how to be in charge of it in some way so that it didn't take over, and know that I can open myself up to it in ways that feel safe and supported. And I can also say, no, I'm not interested. I am not open for communication right now.
I love how calm you are when you're like, and then the Victorian people in the basement. And I'm like, I would have been screaming and running up those stairs, maybe fainting on the stairs and crawl. I mean, how do you deal? I just, you know, because immediately you go to The Shining and those two little girls and like that hallway that explodes in a bloodbath. I'm just like, I can't. So how do you do it?
None of my experiences have been that dramatic. It's always been very quiet isn't the right term, but has felt very like it's not, they're not out to hurt me or harm me, and I'm not out to hurt or harm them. That it doesn't feel sticky or negative. Now, I have had experiences where I've walked into a shop that as soon as I walked in, I felt like, wow, this has some bad juju here and not what I'm going to choose not to spend any more time here, and quickly left. But the majority of my experiences is quite positive and very in alignment with what I choose to open myself up to.
Yeah. My question was going to be, do you think, for example, the people in the basement, which, that sounds like a movie title. do you think, you know, these spirits, are they there just 100% of the time, all the time, and they just choose to let themselves be seen by certain people? Do they come and go based on if someone sensitive is around? What's your impression?
I think I like all of that and more. Like,
okay,
you know, the more sensitive people, yeah, they're going to show up for them, maybe in ways that the sensitive person likes and maybe in ways that they don't like. And so I think that's where the kind of scare piece, the scary piece shows up. If the person doesn't understand what's happening or isn't aware that they have a little control over it to say, actually, this is too much for me. I'm not interested in being this. Maybe I am that open, but I can't tolerate it. And I don't know that the spirits or, you know, stay in one place or travel. I guess I've never really thought about it. In this house, they didn't show up in any other place except the basement. So that was something that
I just automatically sort of detest basements. I'm just going to let you know that. And there was this one place in Portland downtown along the waterfront that mm-hmm. I went in. It was a shoe place. This is so long ago. I think selling discount shoes, and I'd never been in there. So I walked in there and it was a really big space on the ground floor. And the second I walked in, I was like, oh, there's something really wrong here. It's so bad. It is so bad. And I left because mm-hmm. I just thought to myself, I can't feel this anymore. It's way too intense.
Yeah.
And whatever has happened here is so bad mm-hmm. that, and then I found out that just across the way, they were building park is the incorrect word, but a place to honor all the Japanese. They had found a mass grave of Japanese workers just across the street. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, I wondered if it was, and this was, you know, during the gold rush and when the West mm-hmm. was being, you know, the trains were being built. Yeah. Yeah, basically. So I always wondered if that was connected. And that those, I mean, so yeah, but when you feel it, you can feel it. And you're like, I got to get out of here. Something bad happened. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think people who are sensitive, it's not something that we talk about a lot. It's not something that people are trained how to manage or how to live with being a sensitive person. I think the phrase that gets, or the term that gets thrown around a lot is, I'm an empath, or I take on I feel how other people are feeling. And while yes, that is pieces of it, but this is like a different layer and a different level of that, that we're not, no one's really talking about. You don't go to school for it. Just say like, here's how you energetically guard yourself or protect yourself when you go into a situation. You're like, oh, something is sticky here and I don't feel okay.
Yeah, totally. Well, I didn't know you could go to school for aerial acrobatics either. So this whole conversation has been just a revelation, I have to tell you.
Love it. And maybe it is. But as you were saying, when you walked into that shoe store and you could feel kind of the something bad, I can't be here anymore. I've also had very different, like the polar opposite of being in a place in Spain and feeling like, oh, I've been here before.
Yeah.
I literally have never been there in this body experience, but there was this very specific place in the Alhambra in Spain where I felt like, oh, I have stood here before. This feels very familiar or very similar. And it felt peaceful and calm and like very normal. And that in and of itself was a little jarring and unsettling. But so I think there's also that opposite experience too.
This would be the perfect segue to ask the main question of the podcast. Not that you haven't shared stories already. But I would love for you to share, you know, you can share one or two, however many of, you know, an incident where you thought maybe something magical, or this sounds so ridiculous to say to you based on what we've talked about already, but magical, miraculous, or mysterious. Again, would love to hear it.
Well, so one of the biggest ones, and I feel like in my childhood, this was like happening constantly for me, but in adulthood, I was 26 and I had been dating this man for about 9 months, and then our relationship ended, but still very connected to him. And I had a dream, and this was back in the days of the flip phone, and his name like popped up on the little screen. And in my dream, I picked up the phone and I said, "Hi, oh my gosh, how are you?" And he said, "I just called to say goodbye." And I woke up from the dream, and 2 hours later, I got a phone call that he'd died.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was just like, even telling you, my whole body just had tingles sharing this. But it was, I didn't think much of it. I have dreams all the time where people are showing up or saying things or this and that, but it was, I just called to say goodbye, and I immediately woke up following that. And then a few hours later, got a phone call telling me that he'd passed away. And I was like, that is some weird, unexplainable. Okay. Wow. So
what did you think? I mean, after you heard that he'd gone, did it give you a reason to maybe think of your dreams as another space or place to find out the future, or to cross, I don't know, cross into realms that people normally can't?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been a very vivid dreamer. So I think in the moment, it didn't strike me as odd or unique, or you know, I lucid dream, I dream in color. I have all these experiences that when I tell people, they're like, what? How is that possible? My partner, I'll tell him my dreams, and he's like, I feel like that you're a little kid telling me about their day, and all these things happen, and then so-and-so showed up, and then I went here, and then I saw this. And so I think in that moment, it wasn't something that struck me as special or unique or different. But I think after I got the phone call letting me know that he had passed, I really treasure that moment, that connection of like, oh, there was this really deep connection that he and I had, enough that he showed up in a dream to say goodbye to me.
Oh my gosh. First of all, I'm sorry about his loss, but
yeah.
I mean, do you ever, when you think about people that you've loved that are no longer here, maybe best friends, maybe exes, family members, do you ever think to yourself, and I hope this isn't offending you at all, but, oh, like your heart is okay with it because you know they've just gone somewhere else for a while. Does it ever feel that way?
Yes and no. I think it depends on kind of how they exited and what that journey was. If it was something that, I hate to say planned, in not a suicidal plan experience, but in like a, they've lived a full life experience, that feels very different than losing a person my same age or younger than me, and what that kind of does. Or when I'm trying to remember how old I was when a younger cousin passed away, and it was the cousin I was like the closest in age to. And I just remember being at his funeral and standing outside in the parking lot and looking, like literally having this moment of like, oh, I want to tell so-and-so this. And I was like, oh, no, oh, they're gone. And that just wrecked me. And so I think as I've gotten older, my relationship to death and dying and grief and loss has shifted. And it is more of a cycle and a circle than maybe I thought of it when I was younger. And just coming to terms with my own mortality and my own relationship to death and dying. Not to say that I don't experience sadness when someone dies. I absolutely do. But it's that the process of really allowing myself that process and to connect with them in whatever way feels supportive in that moment or years later. Because yeah. I'll still think of that partner that passed and that, you know, think, oh, okay. And whenever something pops into my mind, I see it as like, for some reason, they're showing up in this moment. So how do I get to take a minute and just connect to that and acknowledge it and be aware of, I may not understand why they popped into my head or why, you know, someone else popped into my head in that moment, but I can acknowledge that, okay, I'll pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just thinking about all your experiences, you know, with the people in the basement and the other energies you've sensed. And then this ex, you know, in your dream saying, I just came to say goodbye, or called you to say goodbye. You must have a very different view on death and not being here. Would you say that's true?
I mean, I'm not sure if I have a different view on it. I think I must, if I talk about it in this fashion, but for me, it feels very normal, kind of like my childhood, right? It didn't feel different. So I must have a different view on it. I imagine when people in my life pass, it will be hard and it will be sad and I will go through a grieving process and experience. And I think part of me knows on some level that it's okay to die. It's okay to not be in a physical body here, and not everyone is going to stay for the 80-100 years that many people hope. And it, you know, some of it I think is maybe accepting reality. That, what do they say? The only things you can count on are death and taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, but you say reality and I just think we don't actually know what that is.
Right.
You know, yeah. I think about the little people, or I think about, you know, these experiences you've had. And for the most part, Western scientific culture methodology does not make room for your experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that's a shame. But what it also tells me is that Western, they're very close-minded. And very quickly, I think their worldview, I mean, universe view, I guess we could say at this point, is outdated and needs to take the next leap into the next level of consciousness or awareness of other beings, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. This is my hill and I'm going to die in it. I'm just going to tell you that.
Fair.
But I mean, for me, it just gets really aggravating and upsetting and frustrating that I've had experiences that you could say with 100% certainty, there is no way to explain them with any scientific method that we have, to where it's accepted in the canon of scientific.
Yeah.
You know, what all those stories the scientists tell themselves while they're puffing on their cigars.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's and more people are having those experiences. So something has to change.
I hope it does.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, you know, just from my perspective, I could be wrong, but I do think highly creative people, people that live in the creative world, they are more readily able to access these other states or these other level of beings, possibly, you know, because they have incredible imaginations. So it predisposes them to just having a sense of wonder and openness for whatever may come. Yeah. But also because I mean, speaking for myself, I guess I should only speak for myself. For me, the weirder the world is, the more delightful I find it is.
I agree. Yeah. I enjoy the weirdness and the quirks and the little off-center experiences we all have. And yeah, and there are cultures and groups of people having these experiences on a daily basis that we are not in community with or relationship with.
Yes. I mean, honestly, I think about the Shinto religion, you know, or the Shinto way, and they're just like, spirits are all around all the time. What's wrong with you? Yeah. How do you not know that? I mean, literally, whether they're plants or animals or people or whatever, they're always here. And I just think that's such a remarkable way to live.
It is. Or to experience the trance world through dance, the trance dance or a whirling dervish connection to that spiritual path in that same way. Like, yeah, we don't have those in our day-to-day life, but it doesn't mean other people aren't experiencing them in their day-to-day life.
Right. I mean, I'm now going back to you spinning in the air with your, and having, what did you say? Your vestibular?
Your inner ear.
Like, I could never be a whirling dervish. Cause again, I would puke everywhere. It would just be bad.
Yeah. I don't know if I could do it now either. Yeah.
It's a young people's thing.
Yes. Or a very practiced.
And just like that, it's a wrap on my conversation with Mari Reisberg, who, as it happens, has her very own podcast called Sustaining Creativity. I was lucky enough to be on the show. It should be dropping any day now, but another time where I got to just laugh with her and enjoy her presence and enjoy a really dynamic conversation. To read up a little bit more about Mari and her podcast and what she's doing in the world, there will be a link to her podcast as well as to her Insta, so you can follow and like and enjoy a little bit more of what Mari is bringing into the world. And I think our conversation really, really, really kind of should make us all wonder about what are these talents, these gifts that probably everyone has, to be honest, of whether you want to call them psychic abilities or telepathy or whatever you want to call them. There's no doubt in my mind that every single person has these gifts. But our conversation, I think, really made me realize again, there's a whole lot more that we do not know about this world and this universe. And I'm really grateful that there are people out there doing the hard work, trying to figure it all out. Now, you know me, this is the part of the podcast where I ask you to rate my podcast, Bite Sized Blessings, wherever you find the show. Those ratings and reviews help other people find this little labor of love of mine. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Mari. What would it look like if you and I woke up every single day with a sense of wonder and play and just awe at the gorgeousness and the creative power in this reality? What would it look like if we started off every day excited to find a stranger to have a new conversation with, excited to invite others to belong and become a part of our community, excited and just gung-ho about creating something beautiful, something the world has never seen. I was listening to a podcast the other day where they were talking about creativity and the concept that ideas are out floating around in the ether, that they are alive and they're trying to find someone, anyone out there to bring them to life. And it explains so much about how different people in different parts of the world come up with the same incredible idea at the same time. Those ideas that are alive are just trying to find someone to channel them, to bring more beauty into the world. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, can you be like Mari and can you partner with those ideas, with that sense of play, with that sense of creativity, to bring something powerful, something new into the world? Because we need people like that, people who will partner with those ideas, partner with those beautiful concepts and say, yes, here I go. I'm going to create something new. And thank you for choosing me. So be like Mari and bring something beautiful into the world. Bring a sense of play and adventure to your life. And I mean, I don't even know. I don't even know what it's going to look like when we all start doing this. But think about it and consider it. And then I'm just going to sit back and I'm going to watch all of you do your magic.
Thank you for coming on the show. You are hilarious. I was thinking to myself, when are you going to start? I mean, no, this is, there's no pressure, but I was like, at some point I see you with a crystal ball in the circus in a dark tent telling people's futures.
You know, I have done that. I have been that person at corporate events. It's a crazy world.
That is amazing. Oh my God. Okay, so I've that's also, been done.
So fun. Yes. I've also been my sister-in-law was that for like, she had to like dress up and she's texting me, what do I tell these people?
That sounds like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it is. It was, but also fun.